Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. Michael Anthony, the executive chef of Gramercy Tavern and Untitled and the Studio Cafe at the Whitney Museum, he will be joining us in just a little bit and talking to us about his career and the restaurants he manages and his philosophy on food. But before I invite him on, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city and some things in the news. First off, I'd like to start by just talking about this Dakota Pipeline that has been in the news a lot. There was a wonderful piece on MSNBC about the Dakota Pipeline and actually the way we as Americans have treated the Native Americans all their life. And it just was such a moving piece. I actually posted it on my Facebook page. It was so moving because, you know, we really don't stop to think about it, but, you know, they were saying, like, the only crime that Native Americans did was they were here before us. But ever since then, we have broken every treaty that we ever set up with the Native Americans. We've pushed them onto reservations, and then we keep destroying their reservations and moving them somewhere else. In North Dakota, this Indian tribe that is rallying to stop the pipeline, they used to live underneath this lake that the pipeline is supposed to go under. And when they dammed the Missouri River, they filled in the whole village with all their sacred land spots and their cemeteries and their towns and villages. And they just filled it in and to make the dam and destroyed their whole way of life at that time, and they had to rebuild. And now they're talking about putting this pipeline that's going to go underneath the lake. And as we all know, pipelines leak. There's no way to guarantee that they're not going to leak, and that would just destroy their land again. And it's just amazing when you really stop and look at the history. I mean, I still remember learning about cowboys and the Indians were the bad guys. And it's just, you know, this history that really needs to be looked at and reported on a little bit more honestly, because it just isn't. And we need to do something to turn things around. And I know that doesn't really have to do with food, but it does have to do with, you know, people who really get how important it is to respect the land and the sacredness of space and a way of life and traditions. And when you listen to this, I'm actually pre-recording today, because when you listen to this, I will be arriving in Torino, Italy for the Slow Food Conference on today, which will be September 22nd. And one of the things about Slow Food that I love so much is how they rally around the indigenous people and people who are really trying to save their traditions and hold on to their traditions and value traditions. And that's something that all of us need to, you know, just pay a little bit more attention to. And, you know, one of the reasons I say we need to get back into the kitchen and all start cooking is because we need to preserve our history and our roots. And it starts with, you know, so much of it is around food. And, you know, I just love encouraging people to get back into the kitchen and save that. And I actually was also reading an article about some young chefs that are really bringing back some of the Native American dishes that have been lost over the years and trying to bring some of that traditional food back. So that's going to be hitting the streets sometime soon if it hasn't already hit a street near you. So watch out for some Native American foods that will be new for us. So some things that are going on in the city that I want to make you aware of. September 24th, this weekend, is the Fresh Hop Fest, and that is taking place at Long Island Hops and Plant Connection out in Riverhead on Long Island. That should be a great event. September 25th is a Chinatown Herb Walk that is being sponsored by the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and it's not your usual Chinese walk. It's actually a walk through Chinatown going into herbal medicine shops and meeting some Chinese doctors who are still using herbal remedies from hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And so it's a really nice exploration of using natural herbs and medicines that have also been lost over the years. So Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, is just a wealth of information, and her partner, Dr. Z, is amazing too. So check that out, September 25th. You can register. There's a link on my website for all of these things I'm telling you about at ieatgreen.com. September 30th is the Yale Food System Symposium. This is their fourth annual Food System Symposium, and it's up at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and it should also be a great event. The theme this year is Feeding a Growing World, Perspectives in 2016. So check that out. October 5th is the New York City Food Policy for Breakfast at Hunter College. Every month they have a great event there. And this one is going to be a panelist, including Chef Seamus Mullen, who's the chef and owner of Tertulia, which is a modern Spanish cuisine restaurant in Manhattan. Dr. Robert Graham, who's been a guest on my show before, he's, you know, really bringing food into the forefront in medicine. Karen Pearl, who's also been a guest on my show, from God's Love We Deliver. It should be a great panel discussion, so check that out. That's October 5th from 8:30 to 10:15 at Hunter College, 3rd Avenue and 119th Street. October 15th, 16th is the Monsanto Tribunal and People's Assembly. I don't expect anyone to go there. It's at The Hague in the Netherlands, but in solidarity, you can make donations, and you can find out more about that on my website. But Monsanto is, you know, just one of these companies that really has got to be stopped. They're if we let them continue on the path they're going, they will control our food, and that's a scary thought. October 14th is the Farm to School Conference in Maine. That is from 8:30 to 4:30 Friday, October 14th at Bates College. October 23rd, there's a yoga retreat and farm to table cooking class out here at the IE Green Homestead. We will do yoga first for a couple hours, and then there will be a end of the season harvest from the garden, and we'll be making delicious vegetarian vegan food, including using our Long Island cheese pumpkin, which is a Arc of Taste heirloom variety of pumpkin. And we're going to make a raw pumpkin cheesecake with that, and also some pumpkin chowder. So come on out for that event. November 16th to the 20th, Growing Power is having their annual conference, and that is out in Milwaukee. Growing Power, if you don't know about Will Allen's work, check him out. He is a mover and shaker, amazing. So that should be a great conference. November 12th and 13th, right here in New York City at the Manhattan Center, or the Time Center, I'm sorry, is Change Food Fest, Growing the Good Food Movement. And the same woman that organized the TEDx Manhattan is now organizing this event, Change Food Fest, and that should be a great event. So check that out, November 12th and 13th. And like I said, you can find links to all of these events on my website. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Michael Anthony. As I said before, he's the executive chef of Gramercy Tavern. He is also the executive chef of the new restaurant Untitled and Studio Cafe at the Whitney Museum of American Art. Mike has worked in the kitchens of Restaurant Danielle and at March Restaurant. He also worked at Blue Hill, their Manhattan restaurant, and later at Blue Hill Stone Barns up in Westchester. And in 2008, Gramercy Tavern earned the James Beard Award for Outstanding Restaurant. In 2012, Michael won the James Beard Award for Best Chef, and this year, he won the Best Outstanding Chef in America Award. So, Michael, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So, so I love what you're doing, and, you know, when I was reading some more of your bio before having you come on the show, I was really surprised to find out that you actually did not start out going to school to become a chef. You actually started out going to school for business, French, and Japanese. So can you share with us?
That's true. I did not find my calling until a little later in life, but interesting that, you know, while every, person's story in the restaurant world, especially in the American restaurant industry, is a bit roundabout, that's certainly not a traditional path, but I think that more and more we find that people that are excelling in the American restaurant industry, you know, do come from a colorful and wide variety of backgrounds. Mine was just simply I had decided to go to do an undergraduate degree at Indiana University. Having grown up close by in Cincinnati, I fell in love with the campus in Bloomington, and my parents are both graduates of Indiana University, and from early on I fell in love with it and fell in love with the idea of going to school there, studied languages and business, and I had a great eye-opening experience of just seeing my world and my tastes grow. And as a result of that, I found myself with the opportunity of traveling. And it's through travel that really, I loved the connection to learning about other cultures through food and making friends that way. It is really what sparked my interest in this as a career, and cooking as a career, and continues to, be a main vehicle in which I can kind of search for inspiration.
Mm-hmm. And did you actually have formal training, or did you learn on the job?
A little bit of both. I did not grow up in a restaurant family, but I did work as a, part-time job in restaurants growing up, and then but it wasn't until I was a long way away from family and friends and living in Japan that I said, maybe I'm actually going to, commit to this. And I reached out to the culinary critic of the International Herald Tribune in Tokyo. And, one of those moments of having a very generous person take action on, this American kid's letter who said, he was interested in cooking with no prior professional experience. He was kind enough to introduce me to an inspirational chef, and I had been studying the language enough to find myself, able to participate, and I promised that I would listen carefully and work diligently, and it was just, enough of a crack door to allow me to get into it. And, I think as we all do, when you look back on those transformative experiences in life, as a summary, you can kind of point to the big steps forward. But if I'm really being honest, I think back to the time when I was, actually living this experience, I was not really sure it was going to work out. I just, every day was a challenge, and I honestly don't know if I saw the light at the end of the tunnel, but fortunately I had people around me who, who pressed me forward and, had high demands and, not always in the most polite way, forced me to, to challenge myself and to look deep down inside and say, do you really want this? And, good things happen when you challenge yourself.
Absolutely. So what was your formal training? You went off to school in Paris?
So after having worked for a year and a half in this French-Japanese restaurant in Tokyo, the chef said, I've taught you everything that I know, and your next step is to go to school. And I was really dreaming of trying to get into the Tsuji cooking school in Osaka. And my chef said, nope, you're going to school in Paris. And I thought, like, well, hold on, this is not really what my dream was all about. And, she encouraged me to do that. I ultimately followed that direction and went to a cooking school in Paris, France. And it was a great entry into the business, a vocational school that essentially targets kids between, say, 15 and 18. And gives them vocational training to start work in the real world. It was a very rude awakening, and at the same time, the most amazing discovery. A great start for me, and gave me a chance to make a pretty big jump from Japan to France. And again, I spoke the language, which helped to to kind of not necessarily look at this through the lens of an outsider, but to really to take a good close look up front and the most amazing thing, you know, I think besides the technical experience that I got out of working in both places was, you know, deep understanding and appreciation for the culture.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you don't usually think of French and Japanese culinary trends in the same, you know, in the same sentence. You know, they usually have a very different feel to them. How were you able to blend the two?
Well, you know, I mean, if we look at the development and the evolution of cooking internationally, French food and hence the, you know, international food was deeply impacted by Japanese cooking, especially from, you know, the kind of mid-1970s on, and probably most prominently through a chef named Joël Robuchon, you know, who became very passionate about the minimalism and the natural approach to Japanese cooking. It heavily influenced the development of his personal style. And from then on, you know, there are very few chefs that, you know, have not been in some way interested or impacted by the aesthetic and the ingredients, discipline of Japanese cooking. Fast forward to my story, I admired chefs like David Boulay in New York, and when I came finally to move to New York City, I really thought that you know, that my story would include some sort of melding of French and Japanese techniques and aesthetics. It seemed to me at a time in the, you know, mid-90s that was, you know, very appreciated and, you know, a little bit ahead of the curve. And little did I know that while I was living and working here, I would, you know, ultimately decide not to forget the, you know, the lessons that I learned in those places, but rather try to adapt them to express something that, you know, really came from deep down inside, something kind of truly American, maybe breaking some of those rules to a certain extent, and exploring a little bit of the, you know, trying to break those rules, but with a sensitivity and a sensibility that would allow us to, you know, to say that American food can be every bit as sophisticated, every bit as seasonal, grounded, and rooted. We don't have the hundreds of years of very high-level exchanges between, you know, between whether it's farmer and chef and diplomat, or, you know, dining clientele with no boundaries. But we do have an amazing sense of liberty that comes from not being closed in by those traditions and rules. So I feel quite lucky, you know, to be American and living and working in New York, you know, now. The restaurant business always sees its cyclical changes. But along the way, I think it's the experience of visiting other cultures that keeps a very refreshing take on who we are and what we, you know, what we try to establish as our own culture.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so interesting as you talk about rules and, you know, and the liberty we have as Americans. And I've really felt that, you know, I've been going to the Slow Food Conference for the, you know, I guess this is my fourth time heading to Terra Madre in Torino. And as much as I absolutely love slow food, and it's, you know, seeped in tradition. I mean, that's really so much of what slow food is about, is holding on to traditions and preserving traditions. And I've also gotten to see how sometimes the traditions are really, can be limiting. You know, it's like in our country, you know, very often you get dessert and you get coffee with your dessert. And in Italy, it's not that way. You have your dessert, and then you have your course, and then you have your coffee course. You know, your espresso at the end, and you don't have it at the same time. And, you know, and when I ask for it, you know, they roll their eyes and they won't give it to you. They say,
well,
nope,
you know,
you just wait.
With the spread of information, we have the ability to preserve traditions. And, you know, hanging on to traditions is a powerful and important part of our lives. You know, it's like studying history. We have to know where we came from in order to understand where we're going. What I love about living and working here in the United States is there, you know, sometimes there's opportunity in recognizing you know, that the future really isn't, you know, fully explored and discovered. We have a general curiosity that allows us to, you know, push the boundaries. And fortunately, we live in a stable place, a relatively stable economy, where people continue to dine out. As much as I agree with what you said earlier in the show, that it's not counterproductive to encourage more people to cook at home and reconnect them with their kitchens, because as, you know, our familiarity and sophistication and even just plain old deep-rooted our own traditions are, evolve, it cannot be a spectator sport. We can't allow for cooking to only fall into the hands of specialists. We know that there's a certain commitment. There is a time commitment, a dedication, a certain knowledge that has to be passed on from one generation to the next in order just to get the job done, which means food on the table. I mean, I'm a dad. I have three kids, and while I, you know, have high aspirations for introducing them to healthy, wide variety of foods, you know, I'm in the same position that any parent is, and the clock is ticking, and the tastes are influenced by friends around us. So, you know, I always say it, you know, not from the regular source. You hear chefs say how hard our industry is, but I just think that plain old being the cook wherever you cook is a really courageous and challenging thing to do. You're taking on a huge responsibility of, you know, both literally feeding folks and, you know, you're stepping out into the spotlight to make decisions about, you know, how they'll spend their time together. What sort of stories, you know, will be told? How are you, engaging people's imagination in around the table? I think it is a really big deal, and I want to just say that, you know, for anyone who's willing to take it on, whether you're cooking for yourself at home or your family and friends for pleasure, or, you know, doing it professionally, I think that it's a really important and courageous job.
I agree with you, and such an important one. I mean, you know, teaching our children to eat real food and to not eat the processed food that they see all around them. I mean, you've mentioned the influences from friends, and I know raising my children, that was one of the hardest things. When they were young and I had control up until the age of 5, it was not so hard. But once they start going to school and they, you know, my kids went to school before, I think, Lunchables came out. But those Lunchable thing, I was a teacher at a school, and I'd see these kids coming with Lunchables and these little round pepperoni things. You know, it's just as shocking.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you try to talk to the parents about bringing healthy food, so they send yogurt that have sprinkles on top. You know, and it's a real challenge, the influences and the marketing that food manufacturers do to children to try to encourage them to eat bad food. And, you know, I think, like you were saying, getting yourself into the kitchen and cooking and expressing and feeding people and imparting your love into that food is nourishment as well. And it's just so important.
Well, I think all of that becomes, you know, the things that we pass on to those around us. I do think that, you know, I try to lead the topic of food with enthusiasm. You know, chefs are good people to invite to parties. They usually bring something tasty. They bring a lot of good stories, and generally speaking, they laugh really loud. But it's, you know, I think we spend a lot of time, you know, whether it's at home with our kids, at work we spend a lot of time with elementary school kids, to try to just simply open their eyes to the exciting, weird, and fun activity that surrounds cooking. And, you know, we all know what the obstacles are. We're all faced with time constraints and with unknowns and, you know, with the cost of, you know, buying the right tools and, you know, searching for good ideas. There are challenges. But if we can just lead with a sense of enthusiasm, for, you know, making these discoveries. I try to be really careful and balance the approach of getting my kids to eat new things, but not insisting on it. I mean, I will say that I wrote a book called Views for Vegetables, which expresses my enthusiasm for cooking with seasonal local vegetables. But, you know, in no way, shape, or form do I want to come across as hypocritical, because there was no kid on the planet that was pickier than I was when I was a little guy. And I wrote the book with a certain sense of sympathy for both parents and for, you know, for questioning, challenged, finicky eaters. You know, there are tons of questions that come up in answering the question of what will I cook for dinner tonight. I just wanted to give people a sense of encouragement, you know, some pointers, very literal, technical help in terms of organizing a meal that's healthy, diverse, and interesting and delicious in a time frame that's, you know, that matches most ordinary home cooks.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted for, you know, along the way that when I pull an interesting shaped, heavy, beautifully colored ingredient out of the CSA box that we get every Friday from our favorite farm, Norwich Meadows Farm, I want for my kids to see that sense of wonder that really got me in this business in the first place of, look at this amazing thing. If you just
right.
take a second out of your busy day and kind of admire how strange and, you know, in some ways even magical these ingredients are, that for me is both where the joy is of opening windows onto, you know, new moments in our lives, but also where the inspiration comes from of like, hey, how am I going to cook this thing, and how does it need to be peeled, and if I use this ingredient and that ingredient, maybe it'll, you know, it will ameliorate its flavor and, you know, win over my kids, or just have somebody around me say, wow, that's really clever, that's really delicious.
Mm-hmm. And I find when kids actually see the vegetables, or when they get to even better work in the garden and pick the vegetables, you know, they have a much more open curiosity to try it than,
yeah,
you know,
when it's fun, like they're out there picking the apples or shooting the corn husks out of the corn cannon or walking through the maze or, you know, kind of all of those things that attach kids to the world around them, you know, makes it real. It makes it approachable. It kind of becomes... It becomes theirs. It's hard as a little kid to stake ownership of the world around you. You're kind of, everything is a hand-me-down. Your parents, you know, show you how to interact with the world, and there are very few things that kids get to interact with on their own terms.
Yeah, so true. Now, when you worked at Stone Barns at Blue Hill, you really got to, you know, firsthand work that farm-to-table experience, having that beautiful farm right there at your fingertips. Was that concept, that training of farm-to-table, something that was really relevant in your training in Paris as well, or is that something that you got when you got here and were actually at a restaurant that had a farm?
Well, the idea of finding inspiration and eating seasonally and sourcing food locally came from the, you know, the living within traditions that, you know, that comes as second nature. And those are the pillars of, you know, French and Japanese cooking. But, you know, the fact that the project Blue Hill Stone Barns came to be was one of the most amazing dreams come true. I felt very lucky to be a part of, you know, the opening team and an intimate part of seeing that project blossom. It continues to be a life-altering experience for most people who come in contact with it, and it certainly was for me. I love the time that I spent there.
Mm-hmm. I heard Dan Barber talk, you know, tell a story about, you know, a French chef visiting his restaurant and tasting his butter, and, you know, I'm not remembering what chef it was, but just tasting the butter and knowing that there had been quite a bit of rain and that the butter, you know, the cows were not grazing on the grass that was right outside the barn. They must be in a faraway field. and there was one other thing, but he could, you know, his taste was so honed that he could tell the difference, you know, whether it had rained or not. And I just found it was such a great story because, you know, I'm a chef, but I know my taste is certainly not that particular. And have you run into, can you do that? Can you taste the difference in, you know, butter that's like, you know, comes from whether there's been a lot of rain or not a rain? I mean, that just seemed exceptional to me.
I'm not sure that, you know, my taste is honed in on butter to that degree, but I think, you know, what is amazing is that, you know, there are people, one, that are that closely connected to the land, and those observations come from admiration as well as just a close sense of a priority. And by, you know, by being connected to the world around us, it opens our eyes to nuances that are all around us. We just don't all pay attention to them. So
right.
the notion of being able to, you know, kind of observe and participate actively with the lifespan of livestock or plants as they grow, listening to the growers themselves who are the most passionate and knowledgeable, you know, is an incredible experience. And so I think in everything that we do in the kitchen, underneath it all, we are actually satisfying a craving that most everyone in our society has these days, and that is to be reconnected to the physical world around us. Because we all know that our health and our future depends on the natural world around us. Whether it's for soothing, for pleasure, for health in the future, we recognize how important that is. And I think you mentioned this earlier in your show, this notion of it impacts our decisions. It guides, you know, young people who will be the leaders of tomorrow to see the world in a way that is maybe just a little bit less indifferent than you know, our generations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Going back to your book, V is for Vegetables, you know, the photos, the recipes are just so great. Can you share with us a few of your favorites from the book?
Yeah, well, let me say that, you know, the person who took those great photos' name is Maura McAvoy, and she is a wonderful photographer and a great friend. We also worked on the Gramercy Tavern cookbook together, and it was through the guidance of Dorothy Kalin, our the co-author of the books and masterful storyteller that, you know, nurtured so many careers that came together to work on both of those projects. You know, what I'm most proud of is that those books are, one, made for people to use. They are not intended to sit on coffee tables. As beautiful as they are, they were really intended to hopefully find their way into people's home kitchens or professional kitchens to have, you know, pages turned down and sauces splattered on them. We wanted to write books that are both personal and tell a personal story. The GT cookbook tells about a little bit about the origins and conception of the restaurant, and mostly about the key players of people throughout the years who have turned that into such a beloved restaurant. But then it also tells the story of where the food philosophy and the style of food is headed. The Via for Vegetables is a much more individual take on how I see food, mostly from a home cook's perspective, although that same inspiration finds its way onto both our menus at Gramercy Tavern and at Untitled. We wanted to tell people, it was like both books should be a bit of a guiding hand of saying confidently and persistently, you can do this. Here are some ideas how I like to do it. But don't be afraid to read the book, practice it once or twice, and then close the book and do it on your own. The most important point of this is to get people to cook. I talk about ingredients in Vias for Vegetables Some of them are as ordinary and findable as zucchini or iceberg lettuce. There was nothing off limits that the average home cook can't find. But at the same time, I wanted to encourage people to take a look at the vegetables that I love to cook with that actually grow around us, things that most Americans aren't so familiar with, like kohlrabi or sunchokes. I tried to impart a sense of value in heads of cabbage, which, like Rodney Dangerfield, don't get any respect in the vegetable world. I even talked about some helpful hints of making hard-to-love vegetables actually lovable, like rutabaga. And then mostly I combined the influences of having lived in France and Japan and cooked for, you know, over 20 years now in the New York area, to really try to say something about, there's a way to, live well and eat well without it being extraordinarily expensive, incredibly time consuming, that ordinary people can find real pleasure in ordinary days of their lives by making food, one of their top priorities.
Mm-hmm. So what's one of your favorite recipes from the book?
I took a carrot, and granted, these are great fresh carrots that were grown close to home here, and I gave a recipe that's a very basic Japanese home recipe called kimpira.
Oh, I
love
that.
To shred the cabbages. Traditionally in Japan, the carrots, traditionally they would mix it with burdock root, but that can be hard to find for the average American cook. So I substituted with other ingredients. I used salsify. You could put a wide variety of things like celery, or, you know, anything that has a firm texture, lightly sautéed in sesame oil, a little bit of garlic, splash of soy, and the seasoning that comes from this warm salad is something different than I grew up with, but also something, you know, quite practical and lovable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good example of ordinary ingredients in which I used some of the flavors that I encountered along my travels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I love kimpari, and I do use it with burdock root, which you can usually find. I think it's also called kobe. Is that right?
In Japanese, they call it gobo.
Go-go. You can sometimes find it at Whole Foods, but it has such great medicinal qualities, and it's very different than a lot of other vegetables, so it's really nice for people to experiment with that, too.
Very fast. It goes in lunch boxes, great. We've even used versions of it, as components on dishes in the restaurant. So whether you're at home, which it is a home-style dish in Japan,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, entertaining, it's one of those great things that you can cook in advance, and you don't have to run around at the last second to make it happen.
Uh-huh. When we had first met, I talked to you or asked you a question about, you know, the vegetables mostly being side dishes and whether you've been able to transform some of them to be more main entrees.
I'm still working on it.
Still working on it? I heard a friend of mine, I thought maybe you had, because a friend of mine said she had the most delicious vegetarian meal at Gramercy Tavern. So
yeah, well, at Gramercy Tavern there is a whole tasting menu that's dedicated to vegetables, not always uniquely vegetarian, but always guided by the story of what's growing locally and seasonally. At Untitled, we took it a step further and actually made a whole section on the menu devoted to vegetable dishes. Same, not always vegetarian, but driven by interesting, creative, creatively conceived dishes that are intended to, in my version of a perfect meal, they become the second of three savory courses. We mm-hmm. generally encourage people to start with a snack, which are sold by the piece, followed by a vegetable dish, and then finish with a meat or a fish as an entree. It's still a work in progress because, you know, I recognize that most Americans, they see the world through appetizers and entrees, and they also see the world of vegetables through side dishes. Whichever way makes people happy is fine by me. I just have attempted to try to express that, you know, vegetables give us a great palette of interesting flavors and a great new source of inspiration for cool dishes. So I tried to highlight them in the middle of the meal. We'll have to give it some more time to see if it resonates with people.
And they're also so beautiful. I mean, the colors with vegetables are just so beautiful. So cooking with them is just artistic.
There are a lot of folks that have tried our food at Gramercy Tavern and at Untitled and feel strongly about it. I see an increase in the sales of all of those dishes. I think they become both a really hearty and interesting way to explore what's growing in a particular moment. And at the end of the day, the goal is really to hopefully get folks to remember not just that they had a great time, or simply that they were welcomed in a warm way. All that's important, but we're hoping that each of the meals says something specific about the time of year in which you enjoy them. So a great meal right now in the kind of last very hot days of a lingering summer here in the East Coast will kind of leave you with one memory. And if you come back in 6 months and when the weather has changed, we'll still be cooking with local ingredients, but the rhythm and the choice of ingredients will be completely different.
Right, right. Like I was saying, my cooking class, you know, when it's going to be the end of October, you know, we're going to have pumpkin and, you know, the fall vegetables, and that will be the menu. But right now, figs are really big right now, that we're harvesting figs, and I actually forgot to share a recipe. Usually at the beginning of my show, I share a recipe. So if you don't mind, I'd like to share a recipe right now that I just created from, there was a wonderful fig tart recipe in the New York Times a few weeks back. And one of the things I love to do is I love to take recipes and then transform them, make them gluten-free and vegan, because a lot of my clientele, that's what they're looking for.
Right.
So I made this gluten-free vegan fresh fig tart, and it was inspired from the recipe that was in the New York Times a few weeks ago. And for the crust, I used, instead of butter, coconut oil. So it was 3/4 cups of coconut oil, 1/4 teaspoon sea salt, 3/4 cups of organic confectioner's sugar, 1/3 cup of almond flour, 1.5 teaspoons vanilla extract, 4 dates, and instead of egg, I use 1 tablespoon ground flaxseed mixed with 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar and 1 tablespoon water. Let that sit to get so it gets a little glutinous, and that will be my egg and help hold the crust together. And then 1 2/3 cup of gluten-free vegan flour and 1 cup of ground oats. And I pulse that in a food processor, basically, all together until everything came together. And then I added the flaxseed and 1/4 of the flour. And I pulsed it all together. And the dough, you can separate it into two parts. And one part you can use now and one part you can freeze for later. The tart pan that I used ended up being, instead of a 9-inch, a 10-inch, so I actually had to steal a little bit from the other half of the flour. But this flour I didn't have to roll out like a regular crust. Instead, I just pressed it into the tart pan, and it worked really well. Just crumbling the dough into the tart pan, pressing it down really hard, and then pressing against the side so that it gets the fluted edge. And when I press against the side, I also press down with my thumb to really make a really nice, even thickness in the crust all the way around. And then for the tart filling, I did 3/4 cup of cashews that I had soaked for 3 hours, 2/3 cup almond flour, 3/4 cup of organic confectioner's sugar, 1 teaspoon cornstarch, 1 teaspoon baking powder, 1 teaspoon gluten-free flour, 5 tablespoons coconut oil, 1 pinch of sea salt, 1/2 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1/2 teaspoon almond extract, 1 tablespoon flaxseed again mixed with 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar, 1 tablespoon dark rum, 1 cup of organic fig jam, and 18 ounces, basically like three cellophane packs, large packs of fresh figs. And for that, I heated the oven up to 325. I drained the cashews after they had soaked, and I blended them in a food processor with a half a cup of water until they were very smooth. I sifted the dry ingredients together, the flour, the sugar, the cornstarch, the baking powder, and the gluten-free flour into a medium bowl. Into the food processor, I added the coconut oil, the salt, the vanilla, and the almond extracts, and I pulsed that together. Then I slowly added the flour mixture. Then I added the flax seeds to it until it was all incorporated, and I put that cashew cream mixture, almond mixture, on top of the tart, and then baked it in the oven for 30 or 40 minutes until it was golden brown. And when I removed it from the oven, I let it cool completely before I spread the fig jam all over the top of it, and then I decorated it with the figs in a concentric circle, and it came out beautiful. It looked just as beautiful as the picture in the New York Times, and it was unbelievably delicious. So for those of you that want to try it, you can find that recipe on my website as well. So, Michael, thank you. I'm sorry to have cut you off in that.
That sounds like a delicious recipe.
It was really so good. It was a winner. But yeah, I wouldn't have made it without that inspiration. So, you know, I get my inspiration, you know, from chefs everywhere that, you know, you included, and your book was, you know, wonderful. It is wonderful. And like I said, I just look at the pictures and then I want to make something out of the recipe. And
thank you.
It's just really wonderful. So I just want to also touch on the whole issue that has been in the news lately about minimum wage. And I know you're working, Danny Meyer has really done away with tipping. Can you share with us how that's going? Like, how is your clientele responding to that? How are your workers responding to that? Because it's really a change and it's a shift, and I think it's a good one, but I just want to know how it's going.
Right. Well, so far, so good. Company has taken a courageous stand on the subject and decided to kind of lead the curve in terms of exploring an initiative that we think over time will unlock our ability to create a professional culture that allows for employees in the front and back of the house to be compensated more fairly and equitably. And all the while, it is only a successful idea if the guests, as well as employees, and the business itself thrive and adapt to the new policies. I mean, we know that from a pure convenience standpoint, this should be a plus to the dining experience. I think Americans challenge the notion of how to define fine dining, we continue to expect delicious foods from each of our regions to be cooked with care and expertise. But at the same time, I think we're exploring new venues and contexts in which to enjoy the food, and so just simply finding a simpler way to enjoy a great meal and then move on to the other things that we enjoy in our lives is a positive. I also feel incredibly lucky that, you know, during my own lifetime, my own career, that our company is addressing the subject. You know, for most of the time that I spent growing up in the restaurant industry, it was a bit of a taboo subject and not really appreciated to bring up. So the fact that we're being a bit more transparent and open and honest with, you know, how folks are compensated within restaurants is an exciting thing. And I love the idea that we're leading towards teams of people who, in the end, will really, truly work together in the kind of teamwork that we promote in our restaurants. I find that guests will continue to have, you know, the ability to give strong feedback when it comes to their satisfaction of the service and the meal. If you like it, great, come back. If you don't like it, you you have the chance to tell our restaurants openly about how they could improve, and we're always eager to listen. And in the worst case scenario, if we can't win you over, then we don't deserve your business. So, you know, there's a challenge there for our restaurants to continue to offer incredible value on top of the warm welcome and hopefully delicious cooking that we've always done. Each of our restaurants is rolling out at their own pace the initiatives, and an incredible amount of time and energy is spent with our teams, so that our employees are able to see and fully understand the subject. It's their livelihood. In our company, we don't make decisions that are thrust on our employees. We make decisions with them. These are decisions that, you know, that impact their family and their career, and so we don't take it lightly. So I appreciate the ability to sit down with our teams and, you know, in a very open way, discuss the steps and decisions that we use to move forward with this. In time, this is a new economic model that will have, you know, the separate departments in our restaurants grow together. We know that whenever there's change, that it raises question marks, and that's a normal part of life. So I always welcome the questions, so that we can challenge our own understanding of the answers that we're providing. Are they thorough? Are they well thought out? Are they sensitive? Will they be successful? So I love that process. It's a kind of a regular part of our working world anyway. And now we're applying this way of thinking to, you know, to some very big aspects of our industry. We believe in the notion that, you know, one size fits one, not one solution that will change the entire industry. So this may not very well work in other markets. But what we do know is that where our restaurants are located, that with the rising cost of labor, restaurants will have to adapt at one point or another. We just want to put ourselves in a winning position so that along the way, we can continue to make our guests happy. We can continue to recruit, the brightest and the best people in the industry. And most of all, I think that once we work out the economic levers that will allow our businesses to operate profitably and to continue to make people feel, you know, welcome and feel like they're getting something of value, I think what this does is that it forces the industry as a whole, all of the smart people in our restaurants, to think creatively about, outside of the financial aspect of our work, what are the other factors that truly lead to a learning experience that, for, you know, for me and for many people who see the restaurant industry like me, have always found that takes a higher priority than actually just what does the paycheck look like. For most of the people who work with us, this is an investment. The majority of people who work in our restaurants are headed to either manage or own their own businesses. And so it's an incredible learning opportunity along the way as to, you know, how to force ourselves into thinking progressively, how to look down the road and anticipate the changing factors that, that impact every business, and how to say something decisive that we believe is wholehearted and full of, all of the aspirations that we always put into our business of how to make this a learning environment. It's what gets me out of bed every day. It's why I still work in this company, because we invest in creating these learning opportunities that naturally curious people are drawn to.
Mm-hmm. I think it's wonderful because the trend to pay a fair living wage, and I mean, of course, you know, most of the waiters and, you know, waitresses, of course, are making a living wage with the tips. When you're at a high-end restaurant, you're going to do very well. As a matter of fact, I would think that many of the servers possibly took a cut in salary by not getting tips. But
in our case, the company is committed to maintaining our staff in a whole situation. So no one individual employee has to suffer as our companies go through this, you know, incredibly interesting but unknown experience.
Mm-hmm.
So from that sense, we're not putting the risk on the shoulders of people we work with. The company is taking a really responsible role in saying that we'll guarantee that we're keeping each department's paycheck at least whole. And we're hoping that in time that, you know, this will represent the ability for our whole team to make more money.
Wow. Well, I think it's a great, wonderful thing that your company is doing, and you definitely are leading the way, and I think it's the way that needs to go, and the fact that you're doing it as a team with communication with everyone on board is the only way it can be successful. So I really salute you in that, and think it's a great thing.
Well, thanks.
And Michael,
we'll
thank you for joining us. We're
time,
just about
you know,
out of time.
Tell.
What's that?
I said we'll keep working hard, and time will tell.
Yes, I think it will. And I just want to thank you again for joining us today. It's been wonderful to have you on with us. And everybody out there listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani and Ayi Green on the Progressive Radio Network with Michael Anthony, chef of Gramercy Tavern and Untitled and others. Thanks, Michael. Bye for
thank
now, everybody.
So
have a great rest of the week, and I'll be with you again next week.
All righty, bye-bye.
Bye.